All right. Well, good morning. Good to be here. Good to be together. Always good to be together. Before we get after it today, let me go ahead and dismiss. I see some young ones floating around throughout the space. And so let me invite, if you are the youngest among us, and even the not so youngest, the general rule is if you can fit one of those tiny chairs, then you are free, dismissed, released to go to children's church. Well, this morning we're going to head to Exodus. Exodus, the book of Exodus, a.k.a. Sefer Shemot. Sefer Shemot, what is the book of names to, if you're Jewish or in the Hebrew, the book of names. If you're grabbing a pew Bible, page 51 will be helpful. The words will be on the screen behind me as well. As many of you are aware, we have finished our journey through the Torah, the first five books of our Bibles. We've made it through what we have been calling the Jesus backstory. We've been taking it, we did take it parsha by parsha. For today, I do want to head back to one moment in particular, noting it begins here at Exodus 18 and 1, chapter 18 and verse 1. Vayishma Yitro. Vayishma Yitro, what translates Vayishma and heard, Yitro refers to Jethro, and Jethro heard, keeping in mind that Jethro is the father-in-law of Moses. And just what did Jethro hear? It says, Ki otzi Adonai et Yisrael mimitzrayim, which in word order sounds like this, how had brought Yahweh Israel out of Egypt? And so in our translation, and how Yahweh had brought Israel out of Egypt, reminding us really of the dominant theme, the overarching narrative that runs through the book of Genesis, or the book of Exodus. It is the Exodus. How Yahweh, and when we think of Yahweh, think of the fullness of the presence of God. And so how the fullness of the presence of God brought the people Israel out of Egypt. At least that is the primary theme for the first half of the book, kind of the major thrust through the first 17 chapters. And it's here then, when we read 18 and 1, Vayishma Yitro, that acts kind of like a summary, that it kind of wraps everything up. And so if this were a play, then this would be the point where the curtain starts to drop and we stand up and we clap. And then we head out for intermission. And as we head out for intermission, and then we come back in, the interesting thing is that when we come back in for the second act, it begins with chapter 19. Chapter 19 flows into chapter 20 and gives us the Ten Commandments, which begs that question, what about chapter 18? What do we make of chapter 18? Which, according to rabbinic scholarship, is a rather mundane, boring, innocuous, sort of bland chapter, sandwiched in between what is, and we can think here, the Exodus, Act 1, this epic experience, right? The wind and the waves and the parting of the Red Sea, sandwiched in between that and Act 2, what is Sinai and the Ten Commandments and God descending in fire, and there's smoke, it's billowing, and there's thunder, and there's lightning, and sandwiched in between is chapter 18. And so the question is, what about 18? What is it that 18 has to offer us? It's a question posed by rabbinical scholarship, as Rabbi David Block puts it. In between the Exodus and Sinai, we get a few vignettes that seem disconnected from the story, and the Yitro story is one of them. He goes on, why would these epic events in which God shows his power with Egypt and then reveals himself to Israel be interrupted by this seemingly insignificant story about Yitro? And yet, as is often the case, it is the seemingly insignificant that tends to rise up and offer us something of meaning and value and worth. Noting that here in 18, Jethro, he travels to Moses. The two of them engage in a conversation together. It's now the next morning when he goes out to preside over disputes among the people. And so we have matters of disagreement. We have disputes. We have not seen eye to eye. And verse 14, we read, when his father-in-law saw all Moses was doing for the people, he said, "What is this you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge, while all these people stand around you morning till evening?" Moses answered him, "Because the people come to me to seek God's will. Whenever they have a dispute, it is brought to me, and I decide between the parties and inform them of God's decrees and instructions." Yitro replied, "What you are doing is not good. You and these people who come to you will only wear yourselves out. The work is too heavy for you. You cannot handle it alone. Listen now to me, and I will give you some advice, and may God be with you. You must be the people's representative before God and bring their disputes to him. Teach them, verse 20, his decrees and instructions, and show them the way they are to live and how they are to behave." So in essence here, we have this conversation, right? And Jethro says, "What are you doing?" And Moses says, "Well, I'm doing what needs to be done." And then Jethro responds and he says, "It is not good." It is not good. Lo tov in Hebrew. It's interesting, there is only one other place in the whole of the Torah that we read lo tov, and that is in Genesis 2 and 18, where it reads, lo tov for Ha'adam to be alone, right? It's not good for him to be alone. And so here we get the same idea, Jethro going on to say, "You will wear yourselves out. The work is too heavy for you. You cannot handle it alone. You cannot handle it alone." Jethro then goes on, Yitro says, "But select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Have them serve as judges for the people at all times, but have them bring every difficult case to you. The simple cases they can decide themselves. That will make your load lighter because they will share it with you." And then verse 23, and this is where I want us to land this morning. Jethro adds, he says, "If you do this, and God so commands, you will be able to stand the strain, and all these people will go home." And it says, we read, satisfied. Right? All the people will go home satisfied. What is a nice word? Satisfied. It's a nice word. It's an agreeable word. Right? It makes us feel good, kind of maybe even all warm and fuzzy. Gives us the warm and fuzzies, right? And yet woven into this seemingly insignificant passage is significantly the Hebrew word shalom. Translated here, satisfied, it's the Hebrew word shalom. What is really more than a word? It's more like an experience, and even more than an experience, it's like a movement, noting it begins here, right, in the midst of disputes, disagreements, not seeing eye to eye, at odds with one another, and yet finds its way, we read, to shalom. Simply put, shalom is translated as peace, noting to the ancient Israelite, it has a deeper meaning of to be made whole. It's this idea of to be made whole. And it's that idea of shalom that we find then flowing in and through the life of Jesus. From the Gospel of John, chapter 14, opening line, Jesus is speaking here. He says, "Do not let your hearts be troubled." Right, again, we can think at odds, not seeing eye to eye, disagreements, disputes. "Do not let your hearts be troubled. Believe, or better yet here, trust or lean into." Believe, I will say it probably every time I ever come across believe in the scriptures, pistuo in the Greek. It is not an intellectual assent. It is a full experience of leaning into and trusting God. And so anytime we read believe in the scriptures, think of leaning into, think of trusting, think of a trust fall. It's not just an intellectual sort of assent to something. It's a full body, full mind, full heart, full spirit sort of experience. "Do not let your hearts be troubled. Believe, trust, lean into me." And then dropping down to 16 and 33, he wraps up. He says, "I have told you these things so that in me," right, trusting in me, leaning into me, "you may have peace. from Irene in the Greek. Interesting, Irene is the translation in the Septuagint being the Greek translation of the Hebrew, and so in the Septuagint, it's Irene that translates Shalom. Noting that Irene shows up hundreds of times in the New Testament, Shalom hundreds of times in the Hebrew Bible. In fact, in one Midrash, which is both a mode of interpretation and a commentary, we read in Midrash Tanhuma Shoftim 18, it's there we read, all that is written in the Torah is for the sake of peace. Right? For the sake of shalom. For the sake that we be made whole. That we be made whole. From Aviezer Ravitsky, author and Jewish theologian, he says, peace is among the most hallowed Jewish values. The sages went to great lengths in their praise of peace to the point of viewing it as a meta-value, the summit of all other values. The pursuit of peace, he adds, is the obligation of the individual and the goal of social regulations and structures. Which is precisely what we see here, not only in John 14 and John 16, but also at the very heart of the Sermon on the Mount, what are considered to be the Jesus' greatest teachings. We'll head more fully into that here in the next month or so. But noting here in Matthew 5, Jesus heads up on the mountainside. His disciples follow. They gather around. They sit at his feet. Verse 6, Jesus says, oh, the blessedness of the peacemakers, right? The blessedness of the shalom makers, the blessedness of those who desire to be made whole, who desire to make others whole. Those who pursue peace will be called, he says, the children of God. A peace, writes the scholar William Barclay, a peace that in Hebrew always means everything which makes for a person's highest good. He goes on, in the Middle East, when people say to one another, salam, which is the same word as shalom, they do not mean that they wish for others only the absence of evil things. They wish for them the presence of all good things. Everything which makes for a person's highest good, the presence of all good things. And I think it's in there that we are then invited to reflect, to think, to consider, what about you and me? Right? We can borrow from Aviezer Ravitsky, do I view peace as a meta value, the summit of all other values, that idea of being made whole? Do I view peace as a meta value, the summit of all other values? We could ask, to borrow from the Midrash, does my life reveal the attitude and activity of shalom? Peace, to be made whole. Does my life reveal the attitude and activity? We could ask, does my attitude slant toward all for the sake of peace? All for the sake of peace. Does my posture lean toward that all would be made whole? Does my posture lean toward all that would be, that all would be made whole? In short, do I wish for others the presence of all good things? Can I truly say in my heart, in my soul, in my mind, and can I then live out, right, that I wish for others the presence of all good things? Do I see that in my thoughts, in my words, in my deeds? Do I seek everything which makes for the other's highest good? Do I seek everything which makes for the other's highest good? And we can think family, friends, co-workers, neighbors, and especially in light of Jethro and Moses and their conversation, we can think of those with whom we are having a dispute or a disagreement, those with whom we don't see eye to eye, those with whom we are at odds with. Even that one, do I seek everything which makes for that one's highest good? In 2015, some of you are aware, Mary and I were blessed to travel to Japan. Some of you might remember Masai, a young Japanese lady who lived with us for some time. A number of years, 10 years ago now or so, she she went back to Japan and met a man, and they were going to get married. And so she called me up and said, I'd really like it if you would come and officiate my wedding. And I said, in Japan? And she said, yes. And I said, you got it. Don't ask me twice. So we did. We went over, had the wedding, Mary and I and our two youngest daughters at that time. We stayed with Masai. We did the wedding, and then we stayed with them and did some traveling. The whole experience was beautiful. It was pretty amazing. But one of the things that really stood out, I think, to each one of us was the time we spent in Hiroshima. We might say Hiroshima. In Japan, they say Hiroshima. Perhaps best known historically as the site where the atomic bomb was dropped, August 6th, 1945. At 08:15, U.S. military dropped an atomic bomb there on Hiroshima. But I think really what captured us was, and what was so beautiful and amazing was not just the physical sort of transformation of an area that was in that day just absolutely, completely devastated, but even more was kind of this cultural, communal transformation that had taken place. We spent time walking along Peace Boulevard. It's a beautiful 2.2-mile stretch. We were able to walk the 30 acres of Peace Memorial Park. Again, absolutely beautiful. We were able to walk along the Motoyasu River and see the Genbaku Dome, the Atomic Bomb Dome, as it's called, which was the only structure left standing in that entire area when the bomb exploded, and it has since been preserved, kept in its original state all these years, kept in the state it was in as immediately following the bombing. It is this dome of which UNESCO writes, not only is it a stark and powerful symbol of the most destructive force ever created by humankind, it also expresses the hope for world peace. From one of the park guides we read there, before the bomb, the area of what is now the Peace Park was the political and commercial heart of the city. 4 years to the day after the bomb was dropped, it was decided the area would not be redeveloped, but instead devoted to peace memorial facilities. And so that whole area is peace memorial facilities containing all sorts of symbols of peace, one of which is peace poles. You might have seen them over the years. The Peace Pole Project actually started in Japan in 1955 in response to the bombings of Hiroshima, and then I think it was 3 days later, Nagasaki. There are over now 250,000 peace poles all over the world in every country, and as of this past week, one of those peace poles is now here at Tiger Community Friends Church, donated by the Rotary, who wanted to join with us in pursuing peace. And so as we close today, I would like us all to go ahead and stand. And we are going to step out the south doors and head just east, out in the parking lot there, and you will see the peace pole that has been placed there. And we're going to take just a few minutes and just have a brief dedication to close our service. And so if you would, as you can and able, let's go ahead and head out there together this morning.